Hello, and welcome to the Art of the Cut podcast, brought to you in partnership with Boris Effects and our sponsor, Jump Desktop. I'm Steve Hallfish. This is usually the part of the show where I say I'm a working film and TV and documentary editor, but today I'm super proud and excited to announce that I've been accepted into the American Cinema Editors Organization, so I'm officially Steve Hallfish, ACE. I've been waiting for a long time to join so many of the hundreds of editors that I've had on the show each week that are also proud ACE members. Now, I am too. Steve Hallfish, ACE. Just had to say that again. I've been using Boris Effects products for almost 30 years, and I'm proud to partner with them to bring you some great filmmaking content. Today on Art of the Cut, we speak with director Rudy Valdez and his editor Viridiana Lieberman about the new documentary Carlos, about guitar legend Carlos Santana. Rudy is a two-time Emmy Award-winning filmmaker. His HBO documentary The Sentence was a Sundance Audience Award winner. He's also worked on numerous other projects as a cinematographer. Viri also worked on The Sentence with Rudy as his editor, and she's a director in her own right, directing the ESPN documentary Born to Play, which she also edited. Together, she and Rudy are off on their next project already, a documentary series called Choir. Before I hop into our discussion with Rudy and Viri, a brief thank you to our sponsors. Jump Desktop is a high-performance and secure app that lets you virtually connect to your editing bay as if you were physically there. Keep all your assets in one place and connect to your powerful editing bays from anywhere. Jump Desktop's high-performance remote desktop protocol lets you edit from any low-powered laptop. With end-to-end encryption, native support for macOS and Windows, and multi-monitor support, you can be productive from anywhere. Jump Desktop also has collaborative screen sharing for collaboration with your team. See what thousands of editors have been using to get their work done from across the world. Visit jumpdesktop.com/cut to begin your free, no-limits 14-day trial today. And to our partner, Boris Effects. I've been using Boris Effects and Sapphire for almost 30 years, so they're not just a sponsor to me. I feel like they've been a partner in my cutting room for decades, helping me to deliver on the creative vision of my clients, directors, and producers. For all of us, our work is about bringing a creative idea to the screen, and for me, Boris Effects is one of the important tools I use to do that. See how they can help you on your latest project? Head on over to borisfx.com and check out the Boris Effects suite, which includes Sapphire, Continuum, Mocha Pro, Silhouette, and Optix, all in a low-cost monthly or annual subscription. If you want to read this interview with great visual support, you can go to borisfx.com/AOTC. That site also has other great filmmaking content, so keep that bookmarked. And now, Rudy Valdez and Viri Lieberman on the documentary Carlos, now in theaters.
So, Stephen, this is a podcast about bashing editors, right?
Like, yes.
We're here to...
Okay, yes.
Great.
If you...
I've been waiting for this.
Perfect.
Good. I have some complaints to file. I'm glad this is the forum.
As you can see, we don't get along at all.
I know. That's one of the main things. That's actually an important point to talk about editors, is why you want to work with them in the first place. Rudy, I know you've worked with... It's Viridiana? Did I pronounce
it's
that
Viridiana. Right? That was very Viri close. But you can call me Viri.
Yeah, Viri? Yeah, yeah. All right. Yeah, Rudy, works. You've worked with Viri before. How did you meet, and what made you decide that was going to be a good connection and a good... she would be a good editor for you?
Well, everybody else said no, so I was... I'm kidding. No, it's actually...
I didn't say no. You didn't call me.
one of your people were like, that's possible.
That's possible.
But no, what's very interesting is with my first film, The Sentence, which Viri edit for me, I had some producers come on, and they were bringing in a lot of different editors, some really sort of well-established editors and, award-winning editors and things. And I was meeting with all of them. And Viri came in, who was a recommendation from a very trusted friend of mine. And gosh, I wish Viri wasn't listening, because I'm really going to praise her. But I think we were like 5 or 10 minutes in, and I could tell immediately that we were in sync, sort of the way we approach not only sort of empathy and storytelling, but also the visual part of the empathy of storytelling, and really embracing verite footage. And it was the best sort of interview process thing that I'd ever gone through with anybody for anything. And so much so that I forgot to hire her.
This is true. I went home and I said to my wife, I was like, wow, that was the best first interview I've ever had in my life. We hit it. We were like walking to the train after telling each other our life stories. And she's like, so you got the job? And I was, I don't know. I actually don't know.
I think I might have texted great. You. I might
you
have
did.
Texted
you
and
did.
Like, by the
you're
way,
like,
you're totally.
Yeah. In case
film.
You didn't know. Yeah. It was so great. I want to praise Rudy on that moment, because not only was he so candid with, like, he was very transparent with me in the moment of kind of what people were asking of him and what he wanted, but also that he just kind of wanted to hear what I thought. And he showed me some footage and I just immediately started saying what I would do with it and how much I appreciated it and how powerful it was. And then most of the rest of that interview was really just us as people. It wasn't even, you know, about the project, which was amazing.
Rudy, what was the process and how early was Viri part of the process?
The funny thing is Viri comes on way before people even know she comes on a lot of my projects. Like, she's one of the first people I call. Like, we've not only created this really wonderful working relationship, but just we're very close friends as well. Much like all the other films we've been able to make together, what I love about working with Viri, and again, I wish she wasn't here.
I'm so glad this is being recorded. I'm really excited. I can just play it every morning when I wake up. Yeah.
What I really love is that I'm very much an emotional director. My first pass of anything is pure gut and emotion. It's like, this is what I see this as, sort of visually, emotionally, the sort of ebbs and flows of it. And what's funny is there's a quote in the Carlos film that Clive Davis says, and I always feel like it's very much Viri and I, where Clive says, what Carlos said is he wants to connect the molecules to the light. And what he's saying is he wants to make, and I feel like I come to Viri and I'm like, Viri, there's like a, and then there's a, and I really want this to be a, and she's like, I get, yes, I understand. She understands what I'm saying. And we're able to just sort of hit the ground running. And because I'm like, and then it's like a dream sequence. She's like, I know what you mean. I know. It's funny because we worked in one film where there was another editor in the room and he kind of commented that we never really completed sentences. I'd sort of start saying something and she'd be like, yep. And then she'd start, and then I'm like, but then it needs a, and she's like, yeah. And he's like, what are you guys talking about? Because we just have this real in sync thing that happens. And so it started with me just saying, this can't be a woe is me film. We really have to show this spiritual journey, this musical journey, this journey of a man, and figure out how the ebb and flow of those three elements can be carried throughout this journey. And we set out to figure that out.
Viri, do you want to talk about that opening 2 minutes before the title sequence?
Well, hats off to our additional editor, Sierra Neal, who came in and helped spruce that up as well. Originally, we had talked about opening the film with just a man in the desert by the fire chatting. You know, it was a very quiet thing. And then there was a lot of conversation and desire to really celebrate Carlos as the icon and the process of how he got there and remind, you know, the public of this epic legend. And what excited me most about that space, that section of the film, is senses, the sensory element of it, because that was something we wanted to do with the whole film. So the way Carlos processes the world, his own story, the moment is so sensory. It's what he hears, it's what he smells, it's what he tastes, and how he connects. And, you know, you see it throughout the film. We have these beats that we lovingly called Cosmic Carlos beats during the process, which were just but in a loving way, not in a critical way at all, because we wanted to celebrate that in the way his mind works. So that opening was to just strike you right away that is what this film is. That is who Carlos is, the joy of his music. Everything is at play. All of the elements are at play, you know, with a song that kind of hits you and strikes you in your core and you almost want to jump out of your seat. And so all of that was kind of embracing it, and also him kind of getting settled in to tell you a story. It's an exciting stretch that just hopefully captures all the tools you'll have throughout the film to utilize and really experience him.
That opening stretch also, I think, works so well because, and I'm humbly saying this, but just like the rest of the film, it's not a letdown after that. You know what I mean? It's not like there are so many films that come out guns blazing in the first 2 minutes and then it's like, okay, nah, but like that's all we got. Like that's all we have, and we're going to sort of not give you a ton of information. I feel like it's we sort of come out firing on all cylinders, and then we're able to sort of say, and we're going to continue to back that up with this amazing story and this amazing music and this amazing energy, and all those sensories are being hit in different ways, not just all at once like it is at the beginning, but you're still taking that journey in that way.
I've got a chicken and an egg question, which is, which came first, the elements of the
chicken?
Okay. I believe that. You can't have, yeah, okay. Other than chickens and eggs, let's talk about this story, which is, which came first, the elements that you had or the story you were trying to tell?
That's a really great question. I think that, you know, the search for archive happened immediately once it was like, you're going to be working on the Carlos Santana documentary. The first thing you do is you're like, archive, you know, you're sort of going. But I think that at the very beginning, there were a lot of different ideas about what the approach was going to be. And what happened, you know, right after this film sort of started was the pandemic hit. What that meant was there was going to be a pause in when we were going to start filming, because he was going to go on tour with Earth, Wind, and Fire, and I was going to go to some of those dates and film with him and do all these things. But what happened instead of that was I started doing these phone calls with Carlos. And initially, they were going to be to record, to possibly use in the documentary. Like maybe those were going to be our interviews, because we had no idea what was happening in the larger landscape of the lockdown and all of those things. But what ended up happening was Carlos and I just started chatting and talking and getting to know each other. And one of the wonderful things I was able to experience was that he's an amazing storyteller. He has an unbelievable memory for all of the like these tiny little moments within his life, but he's telling you about things from like 1969, 1978, 1982. And there were moments where I was like, is that right? And I would like fact check. I'd like look, he was like, it was right. Like that, those were the songs that were playing that day. Like those were the artists that were going on. And so what that immediately led me to want to do was say, I don't want to interview 10 other musical contemporaries to reflect on who Carlos was and what that meant. I was like, I think that we could go through this film and live in his voice, live in his storytelling. And then as we started to discover he's a great storyteller, we then started to uncover wonderful archive. And that allowed us to be able to live not only in his stories, but in these sections of time without having to come to this contemporary artist who, you know, was maybe there at the time, but is now reflecting back, because I felt like that would have continued to take you out of that moment in time that we were trying to express to you. So in a way, the film sort of presented itself to us as we started to uncover all of these different elements, because there was so much great stuff there.
Viri, tell me a little bit about how you started to construct maybe scenes. Is that the first thing that you have to do? You just go, I don't know where this is going to live in the film, but I'm going to do
That's exactly what it was. So I'm a firm believer in the card wall. I love building a wall. Rudy and I love putting those cards up. He saves them after every project. Someday I will go somewhere and it'll be a gallery of all of our crazy cards. But yes, it was just building the pieces. One of the first things I built, it's small now in the film, but I was trying to convince Rudy, like I was like, we can just have this giant section of him just getting ready in his seat. And he's telling you how he wakes up in the morning and he washes the shame and the guilt. And he's just like, no, F that, I'm going to go navigate the world. And so I cut that, and it was almost, you could call it like a style test. Like I cut that and then a few other super atmospheric, kind of experimental brushstrokes of scenes and spaces and just thoughts that were going through to build this palette and this landscape and soundscape to see how it was resonating for Rudy. And he was really into that. And, you know, there were things we just knew we had to do. We knew we were going to have to cut the Woodstock scene. We knew we were going to have to do the Fillmore. It was, you know, there were must-dos that were on the list. But we first started on the fringe with more of the personal before we went there, because that kind of, in a weird way to say, it kind of felt easy because we knew that it had to happen. And it was just about kind of capturing the best way in and honoring the way he told it. The rest of this stuff was, how do we honor Carlos and the way he's wired and evoke it through a visual feast, you know, and some kind of space to have some breath? Because the other thing about Carlos that's so wonderful in this film, and what Rudy does with all of his films that's so powerful, is human beings. His history is enormous and he's a legend, but he also is a person. And Rudy is so good at creating those spaces, building that trust, and kind of honoring that. And so this film was also trying to do that. So I wanted to start in scenes where he felt as much of himself away from the things that we've seen a million times, or the things that everybody could read about and see and find the archive on their own, which was really lovely. So yes, starting to build the bricks, did them very separate and thematically, but a lot of it was us trying to find the voice and the approach, which was exciting.
There's great interplay between the interview pieces and the space that was left for music. How did you choose, for example, Fillmore or the washing the shame away scene? How did you choose what piece of music was going to be the heart of that scene?
Now, one of the first things that I showed to Viri when we were uncovering some of that home video archive was the moment when Carlos is singing the "I'm not afraid, I'm not afraid, I'm not afraid," and he's doing that moment, you know, post molestation. And we're looking at the timestamps on some of those videos and things, and we're looking at like when that Rolling Stone article came out, and it felt like it was speaking to that in a time frame. And so there were things that made sense, and there were things that were peeking out to us. And then during the course of making the film, obviously producers and people who are working on this film with us are saying, you know, you have to have certain songs in, you have to have certain things, you have to have Black Magic Woman, you have
more
to
have hits, more hits,
and,
more
yeah,
hits,
more hits, more hits. And I think what we were very careful of and what we did not want to do is just be like, all right, now we're going to play this song, and then we're going to play this song, and then we're going to play this song. We figured out a way to make, like, Black Magic Woman, for example, is played in the film, but it's also emblematic of all of the different band members that he had. You know, you see Black Magic Woman with three different lead singers singing that song, but that happens to fit directly into the moment where we're talking about, you know, all the different iterations of the Santana Band. So we were never playing a song for the sake of playing a song. We were always trying to find those moments that allowed it to play that song, but let it be emblematic of a part of the journey, because he has such a long journey. You can find moments where the song is emblematic of that thing. And so my hat's off to Viri for finding a lot of those moments and making them fit and work within this, the larger sort of human story we were telling throughout, and then saying, and then in this time frame, this is what was happening, and this is how we can use that song. So we were able to satisfy the want for the hits and satisfy our need for continuing to use those to propel the story forward, not just have them in for the sake of having them in.
Yeah, one that came late was Evil Ways. We had a, when we were doing, yeah, the band is spiraling out, there was a live recording of Evil Ways that just did such a cacophony, right? Like, it was just kind of madness. That was a wonderful moment when we didn't feel forced, you know, it found its way into a section of the film and really drove it in a kind of a wonderfully maniacal way. Yeah.
That's the other interesting thing about the music, right? Is you could do Black Magic Woman, but there's probably 10 different versions of it you could choose based on the theme you're going for, or the feeling.
Yeah, and having it rooted in the time, that was something that Rudy and I always wanted to try to stay true to. It wasn't kind of best recording ever or have them all from the new album. It was like, no, try to make it present and in the narrative and of that time or of that space or with those band members, that, you know, it was, that stuff was really important to keep it rooted.
So much of the film was basically scored by Carlos using various archival musical pieces. What was that process like?
One of the other things after uncovering a lot of that home video footage, after discovering, like, look, he can tell his story because he's a wonderful storyteller, we also started to uncover him playing, his son playing the piano. Like, there's all this other music that is just there. And so we said, it's going to be in his voice. It's going to be in his hands, in his music. And so, you know, Viri did an amazing job of, like, coming through and really digging through a lot of that archive and that music, that home video music, and really making the most out of it, because it wasn't always, I think, full songs. It was him jamming or it was things, but really allowing that to be our bed. It was like, he was also our bed of music as well underneath.
I wanted to score the whole film from those VHS tapes. It was wonderful because he would just play a beat and then he would jam for 10 minutes or an hour, or they were wonderful. And so, yeah, I just grabbed portions and rearranged a bit. But Rudy very early on was like, this will be composed by Carlos's music in what all the forms that it comes, because he plays, he jams, he tries, he practices, he like warms up a guitar. I mean, everything he's doing is such a musical language. So it's really, when we found those tapes, I was obsessed. And there were so many, in that moment when he tells the story about the communication with the birds that his father taught him, that was, when we got to score that with one of his jams from those tapes, it was my soul. Whew.
Talk about the pacing of a given story using the music. Because you didn't just do, here's a 20-second music bite and then it'll go under and then there's a bunch of narration. It was a song. It was narration and some instrumental, and the narration would come back 5 seconds later. It's, talk to me about pacing that out.
I think what was so exciting about getting to cut this film, because I hadn't gotten to cut a music doc before. And so when Rudy came to me, I was like, this is so exciting because I want it to feel like a cohesive weave. Like, I don't want start and stops. It's going to feel chapter-esque because he's telling these stories, but in those transitions and how they flow, it should feel like a conversation. And I want the music to feel almost seamless between the hits and the jams and the quiet and the nature and all of that stuff. So the pacing and the rhythm was very much as a complete piece, and it wasn't kind of moment to moment. And so, you know, it just like life, it's like it ebbs and it flows and it gets chaotic and it gets quiet and it gets personal. And then it explodes because the whole world is paying attention. Once again, when I was building those bricks, I'm a real slow burn lady. I start way out there and everybody reels me in. I mean, Rudy doesn't reel me in. They got, like, he will let me do it. But at some point, we will have those other cooks show up, and it's fair. It's fair. You know, there were moments that were naturally going to lend themselves to pick it up, you know, when he was obviously on the road and when fame was coming blasting through him. But those moments when we could rest and just be with him, that all came naturally with the pace of how he told it too. You know, sometimes he would really set it. And so that was lovely. But I really, one of the reasons why Rudy is such a joy to work with is that he'll let me just, I mean, I've always joked that I could watch raw footage as a movie and be happy. I just love watching footage and, you know, and playing with it and finding ways to really study a frame. And I'm that nerdy about it. And so first cuts really set a nice pace that even when we do climb and have to build, you know, things that are more of a ride, you still get to feel based in something that feels natural.
Rudy, talk to me about orchestrating the overall pace of the movie. There are great moments, like I said, of calm or even sadness, and then all of a sudden you'll get a montage of crazy life. How do you determine that the audience is ready for one of those things or another?
Again, I'm an emotional director. And so there will be times when Viri and I are working on a project, and my note won't be like, this scene isn't working or this scene isn't this. It's, I want to feel a little more love here. I want to feel happy here. I want to feel, and we've learned this by taking notes from, you know, executives and in other producers and things. It's like, sometimes they'll say, I'm bored in this section. And it's like, it's not that the scene is bad. It's that maybe what's leading up to it isn't preparing you for that thing. So we're always like finding that ebb and flow of the emotional journey throughout that process. And so with this, I feel like because we were always trying to find, again, that balance of the musical journey, the spiritual journey, the human journey, the key to it, I think, was always, even when the spiritual became the forefront of the story for that brief moment in time, we were never too far from the musical side of that or the human side of that. And whenever the music, like when Supernatural takes over the world and takes over everything, it's like music, 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 music. But what comes shortly after that is the human, you know, and the human leads to the spiritual. So it was all sort of pacing itself, as long as we never allowed it to become just the musical journey, just the spiritual journey, just the human journey. We had to find the ebb and flow of never departing too far from any of those elements at once. And that helped dictate and create the pace for the film.
There's also great humor I wanted to talk to Vera about, at least one cut that made me laugh out loud, which is the story of Carlos's first joint.
Well, he describes how a joint was left in front of him and he had never smoked it. And the joint was saying, you know, he puts up his finger. He's like, it's basically saying, come and get me. And he's like, no, I don't. And then he goes, well, maybe, you know, and then he kind of clicks it. And the greatest thing, this is actually fun behind the scenes for a second, when he then takes a hit and he's like, and then he goes, you know, the film War was never the same again.
His brain explodes.
That moment of him making that sound, there were attempts, not by us, by others, to add sound effects to that, to make it really like shatter in your bums in the seats, just but all these noises. And we were like, no, oh, it's so amazing that he did it. You know, he made that sound. Even the click. I remember, Rudy, you thought I had put a click of a lighter in there, but that was just him making that sound with his mouth. He's such a good storyteller. So a lot of the comic timing, although, of course, I could juxtapose, you know, or wait for the cut and then blast back into the film more. Yes, that's in editing, but it also is Carlos just taking that moment to act it out, to think about it, to have the moment, to wait for the reaction. You know, I mean, he's just very seasoned and just naturally sets me up for that. But that was a really fun moment. Yeah,
but what you're leaving out is that
what did I leave out? Tell me.
That you drop the music in a cut.
Yes. Ah, yes. Well, that was, so it's right when he's lighting it. So like, yeah, the music's going and it was just ambient sound. And then it's like, yeah. And you cut. Now that is something that I am obsessed with sound cuts. Like I love when they're active. I mean, I don't want to take you out of the film, but it, you know, something that kind of elevates it. And that was a fun, I did that very early on. That was like one of the, when we cut the film we're seeing the first time ever, it was like, and then it just cut out and then it came in. Yeah. Just fun. And you know, Rudy is a very funny person. We laugh a lot. There's a lot of humor. He's always kind of looking to find the levity in the humor and stories with the humanness. And so you're always, I mean, Rudy, I feel like you're always all in to embrace those kinds of cuts and those kinds of moves to amplify it.
The thing about being a comedic genius is, I'm kidding.
But you're talking about Carlos now.
Carlos, yeah.
But yeah, oh, I forgot about that. That's so good. I'm glad you got, this is an editing podcast. That's like the magic that you do this and that you pay attention to those details. Cause that was something I was very proud of. And I didn't even, I'm like, oh, he's just talking about.
Oh, I love that. I love things like when he talks about his drug trip in at Woodstock, where Jerry Garcia gives him hallucinogenics. What does he give him?
Acid. Yeah, a tab of acid.
And there is great subtle heartbeat sound effect in there.
Yes. Yeah, when he's like, has to go on. Yeah, you want to talk about comic timing? That was a great, Rudy did this. He made this move. We were sitting there. I cut that sequence early on when we did, we knew Woodstock had to happen when I took on that mantle and I cut that. When he goes, and then I heard, and it's like, would you welcome the Santana? I had cut that in a sequence where he's kind of sitting there and then he hears it and then it's, and Rudy was the one that landed the timing, the comedic timing of that, where he doesn't finish his sentence. He's like, and then I'm sitting there and, you know, and it just interrupts him. So it's interacting like the past, the present, it's all kind of handing off. It's creating this. I loved that. Yeah, that was good comic timing for that one too.
And Rudy, you were mentioning multiple times that you're a director about feel, and there are great sensory moments, like when Carlos talks about leaving home to be a full-time musician, strange, like dreamy musical vibe, funky choices of archive. Talk to me about those. And it felt more like you were going for a feeling than to tell a story.
Yeah, it's very much about finding the feeling and not just pacing in sound, but also the visual. Because I think the visual, when you're seeing the birds go and you're seeing the butterflies when they're going, like there's just like a palate cleansing that sometimes happens. I think that that's kind of our job as filmmakers. And this is one of the reasons why I really love working with Viri, is that neither of us throughout this process go into any of our films and say, we're the expert on this, and we're going to tell you the best version of this. I've worked with other editors who become experts on things. And I'm like, it loses a certain element of humanity, of empathy in the storytelling when you're all of a sudden the expert. Like, how am I ever going to be an expert on Carlos Santana? I think our job is having the patience with the story that's being given to us and figuring out the emotion that it's evoking and how we can enhance that, how we can use the tools in front of us through the archive, through the music, through the visual palette, and say, what is being said in this amazing storyteller that's in front of us, and how can we make that even better? What are they trying to say emotionally, or what is emblematic of that that is at our disposal? Not taking something out of thin air and being like, smash cut, star wipe. It's like, no, like, what is of the element of the palette that we have that can continue to do that? Beery does not.
Rudy's been wanting me to do a star wipe in one of his films since the day I met him.
She's unable to do a star wipe, so we can't use that in any of our films. But
what? Star wipe? Oh, you're breaking up.
I noticed that Ron Howard is an executive producer on the film, and he's done a bunch of great musical documentaries, the Beatles documentary, the Pavarotti documentary. Notes from him.
What's fascinating about having Ron Howard as a producer on this and Imagine documentaries themselves is there is a expectation. There is a world of which we're coming into when we're making an Imagine, you know, documentary produced by Ron Howard film. You know what I mean? So there's an expectation. And I think that we received wonderful notes from Imagine and from Ron and from everybody throughout this process. But I think what they also embraced with us was that we had a unique POV on this and we had a unique vision on this. And I will say that they're wonderful about supporting my vision and letting me, you know, and my team that I bring together really explore that and let us go as far out as we can with it. And we're able to sort of live up to the expectations of what they want to put out.
For you as a director, what's the benefit of an editor? What do you want from them or understand that you can get from that relationship?
You know, I worked as an editor for a few years, and technically when I was making my first film, I could have edited it, but I knew right away that I was too close to the subject matter and I needed somebody else to help bridge that gap of understanding why I love this story. It's a plus that Beery and I have such a shorthand and are like-minded in our want to stay in verite and go far out and do all of these things. But a great editor isn't a tool, something that you're like, go and put that star wipe in. It's somebody that you're collaborating with equally to say, let's together tell this beautiful story sort of hand in hand. And I think it's a very special relationship, a director and editor. And I sometimes feel bad when I speak to other editors and they're like, I don't have that experience with the people.
I know, I was going to say, I am very spoiled. I am very spoiled that a majority of my career has been cutting with Rudy, because I am now, my norm, my desire, the way I work best is in a collaborative way. Like I want a seat at the table. Of course I'm honoring someone's vision, but I'm so excited to pitch ideas and try things and sharpen the machete and take something out and see what happens, and to have that confidence and that space. And of course at the end of the day, it's what, you know, Rudy wants, and honoring what he can't, you know, the themes and the tone and the space that he wants to cultivate. But I now, when I've worked with other directors, I can already tell when I meet with a director, I'm like, oh man, you're wonderful, but I know the process, so I will not enjoy
you're
the
not
process.
Rudy.
Yes. And a part of that is because I don't want to be a set of hands. I want to do more. So few people know what editors do. And for those of us that are editors, whenever we kind of all gather in a room, it's this real world magic moment where we're kind of like, I get it. I know, you know, what we do and how important and how wonderful it is and how exciting and how vital, you know. And Rudy has made me feel more seen than, you know, anybody. So I'm very lucky and spoiled and now completely entitled. It's a mess. If I meet people, I'm like,
she's
nope, this
is
how it's going to
go. She's a monster now.
No, I'm just very grateful.
But she will not execute your star wipe. So
no,
that it only goes so far.
You need to know,
now, here's
dude,
the thing.
I will. I'm just going to throw it in at the
skills.
Perfect moment. I'm saving it for some kind of perfect comic timing someday in the future during his most serious like dry, deep. Yes, just boom. His life.
I think
fire.
You could. I think there were some of those montages, some of those like celestial, crazy Carlos Santana. What do you say? The cosmic
Carlos.
Cosmic it's Carlos.
True. And let me tell you,
Star Wipe could have gone
tell
in
you
there.
Right now, there was can't archive with a Star Wipe. I can do it. There was a Star Wipe. there was a piece of archive that utilized Star Wipes between every one of his songs, and I sent that to Rudy, and I went, well, is it time? Is this gonna happen? Yeah,
I can't do it, but I could put somebody else's Star Wipe
well, yes,
in.
Exactly.
Right. I love it. Well, you know what you did use was split screens.
Yeah. Oh.
So to talk about the use of the split screens and decision to do that, and it seemed like it was only in one section, maybe Woodstock or something.
Go ahead, Mary.
Oh, me?
I'm not complaining about it. I'm just asking about the use of it.
Here's the deal. We should be completely transparent about this. So the Woodstock film, Scorsese, that.
So you just stole Thelma.
Yes. No, we actually, my first cut of Woodstock, I actually punched in. I had cut the whole sequence to be as if we were there and we were utilizing footage from multiple sources. And then we'll just be completely honest. That the price of that and use that footage in that way was more than the entire film times 10.
Yeah.
So we had to retain those shots, and you could only do a certain amount of cuts. Every time you made a cut, it was, you know, cha-ching. I think creatively we've made peace with it. It is a bold choice. And I think for that film, it was a phenomenal choice. But to utilize that footage, we had to honor the way it was used originally. So it was, I wouldn't say it was a choice of our film, but ultimately did kind of add something from the time, I think. It really did. And we were able to emphasize some of the squares, and, you know, we made a couple choices to work with it and honor it for what it was. But that was like a coping process with a legal and a price tag, but it's magical. I mean, that Woodstock story, that performance, and that was one of the first things Rudy showed me. You know, we just watched Soul Sacrifice together, and that was such a otherworldly feeling, and we were like, wow, we have to really experience this. You have to be able to play it and have that moment there.
That process is such a reality of documentary filmmaking at its core, because most of what you, especially when you're telling a story that spans 50 years, most of what you're running into are barriers, are, you know, brick walls that are just like, there is nothing that exists from this time to this time. Figure out a way to tell that story. And with this, we had this amazing footage, and we were just sort of going at it with reckless abandonment. We wanted to see what we could build out of it first without any restrictions. And we built something that we thought we really, really loved and worked very well. And then we were told, well, to do that, it's going to be a very large number because they charge you by the cut. And we were like, oh, and like, and you're not allowed to manipulate their footage and blah, blah, blah. But what ends up happening when you're in a room of creatives is like, oh, here's our sandbox. This is, these are the parameters of which we, and so we sat back for like a day or so, and then we're like, okay, let's figure out what that means. And you find something that works. That's the fun part of this. Even though there was a moment of like, oh, we can't do what we want. As soon as we get over that brief moment, we're like, awesome. We get to find a creative way out of this. And that's the fun of doing this a lot of times. Like, how do we still do it with these blinders on or with this light off? We have to figure out a way to brighten up that room after they told us we have to turn this light off. And we figure out a way.
Limitations are always a huge plus for art.
Yeah.
Especially in docs. I haven't cut a ton of narrative, but I will say, it's so exciting to have to work with what you have. True verite, you know, and really kind of get landing in archive, limited archive, and all that stuff makes for some really inventive moves. And that's so exciting.
Which helped me early on with my style of filmmaking, because I never liked inserts and super wide shots. And so what I started to do when I was a DP is I just wouldn't shoot them. so like early on, but it forced my editors of that time, and it created a style for me, because I'd rather live in this medium and like move with it and do this stuff. But if I give them insert wide, they can cut my material up as much as they want. So I just stopped giving them all the things to cut with, which forced them into a style.
Tell me how you incorporated archival footage from outside of the Santana universe, stuff like the Tijuana archival footage. There's some great 8mm and 16mm stuff. Was that a case of we've got this story point, now we have to go find a way to tell it visually? Or did you know you had the footage in the system and you were just building the story with what you had?
We had to find that footage.
Yeah, it was
a big search for that.
Oh boy, especially Tijuana.
Yeah, it was, because there's obviously a lot of footage of Tijuana, but for it to feel like the right era, we were very limited. And so we had a great team sort of scouring and looking for that footage.
Well, especially when he refers to it as Star Wars Cantina, you're sitting there going, how do we do this tastefully the way that he means, you know, without making, dishonoring in any way or making fun of some aspect of Tijuana, because that's not what he's saying. So
he was painting a picture for us, and we had to figure out the visual version of that.
Thank you both so much for joining me. I really enjoyed the movie, and that was great chatting with you. Before I let you go, I would love to hear a little bit about your additional editor, Sierra Neal.
Sierra was wonderful. She came on as an additional editor at the end and really sprinkled some magic on some sections of this film and just amplified all the things Rudy and I had dreamed of doing in the race to the finish. And that open was certainly a part of that. We also had a slew of incredible archive come in of the group touring after their first. I had moved on to another Rudy project. I was over on another series, and she came in and just used. I had some of those shots from really crude versions of that archive, and then we got this new archive, which of course had extra stuff in it. I mean, it was like there were reels with like after the shot I had pulled, there was more. So she had kind of really expanded and did the, you know, brought it in for a landing in an amazing way with all the additional archive that we had. We had a whole nother archive team come in. It was really this wild final chapter. And Sierra's wonderful. It was great.
We have to also shout out Liz Morheim, our producer.
Oh, yes.
Instrumental in the edit as well. She was amazing.
And she was somebody who loves to watch every single frame and hunt for the absolute best thing. I mean, she would send me the most wonderful things, just that great head turn or the teeniest minute details that allowed us to make such an epic weave. Yeah. And I know her and Sierra were in the trenches making sure until the very last second that only the best got in there. It was very cool.
That's it for Out of the Cup this week. Thank you so much for listening. Again, if you'd prefer to read this interview with visual support and clips and trailers, head on over to borisfx.com/AOTC, where there's a ton of great expert content for filmmakers of all types. Also, check out my book, Art of the Cut, Conversations with Film and TV Editors, for a topic-driven, curated look at the craft of editing. Thanks to Rudy Valdez and Viridiana Lieberman for joining us on Art of the Cut. And thanks to our partner, BorisFX, and to our sponsor, Jump Desktop. Be sure to check them out at borisfx.com and jumpdesktop.com/cut. I'm Steve Hallfish. Thanks for listening. And please tell all the editors and filmmakers that you know that to get more great Art of the Cut interviews every week, please subscribe on your favorite podcast app.